Say a number of things by way of introduction. First of all, this is not intended to be a lecture. We all gain more if the class is participatory. So please feel free to chime in with questions or comments. I won't call on anyone, so you don't have to worry about that. But please feel free to participate at any time, especially if something's not clear. But if you have something to contribute, please feel free to do so. The purpose of this course is to basically produce a survey of Rashi so that by the end, let's say 7 or 8 weeks from now, when you hear about Rashi, when you talk about Rashi, when you study Rashi, when you learn Rashi, it'll have a different resonance because you'll come to the conversation, you'll come to the text knowing something more about what Rashi's out to do, where he's coming from, what his life was actually all about, and what it is exactly that he is contributing to the text and to the narrative. And I hope at the end we'll be able to answer in some form or fashion really the $64,000 question, and that is, what makes Rashi, Rashi? What makes Rashi so fundamentally different from any commentator who came before or after him, that he stands out as the shining pillar of all commentaries of all time? Was it an act of happenstance, or is there something more to what made and has made Rashi into the classic commentator over the last 1,000 years? Okay. Any questions to begin before we jump in? Let me say a word about the format of this class. What I'd like to do is something a little different that I haven't done before in teaching classes here at the Jewish Center. What I'd like to do is divide the class, and it may not always be 50-50, but a first half of the class which will look at some topic or theme, and those themes are basically outlined in a tentative way for you at the top of the syllabus on your handout. And then in the second half of the class, maybe it'll be the last 20 or 30 minutes of the class, I want to learn with you. I want to study the text of the Torah with Rashi and understand what Rashi is contributing to the conversation. And again, doing this over the course of the next 7 or 8 weeks, we'll tease out the elements of Rashi's commentator that hopefully will give us a sense of who Rashi was and what it is, again, that he's bringing to the narrative that makes Rashi, Rashi. Okay. So let us begin. Where's Rashi from? The Frenchman. He's born in the city of?
Troyes.
See, I can't pronounce it. That's why I asked you to say it. T-R-O-Y-E-S, right? Troyes, I think it's pronounced. Any French speakers in the room can correct me. If you have a look at your source sheet, again, the source sheet which says Rashi, His Life, Times, and Exegetical Adventures, on page number 3, you will find a map of Rashi country, as it's called here. And almost directly in the center of the map, you will see Troyes. And just to get a sense of some of the geography to place literally Rashi in context, we're just walking in. There are two handouts on the table, so please grab both. And we have some seats back this way. So this map, just to give you a sense of where Rashi is. Yeah. Now, as we'll talk about a little later, Rashi didn't stay in Troyes his entire life, but also occupied Worms, Mainz, Speyer, made it around what's present-day southern Germany, and was really probably northern France when Rashi was around. Okay. So when does Rashi live? 11th century. Rashi is born in the year 1040 and dies in the year 1105. Rashi is born in the year 1040 and dies in the year 1105. Now, we're going to be jumping to the last page of the source packet a few times. So if you jump with me for a moment to source number 2. How do we know? Who told us, right? I will attempt not to produce anything in this class that I can't. To page 10 in the handout. Okay, so you have two separate packs. One is just an article, which we'll come to in a few minutes. The other is the source pack, which we're going to use today. The last page of the source pack, page 10, have a look at what I've labeled source number 2. How do we know when Rashi lived? So this actually comes to us from a very early responsum of the Maharshal, who actually claimed to be a descendant of Rashi. And he writes, V'Rabbeinu Gershom Kibel Mirav Mirapai, Minifner Shnas Dalid Alafim Ve'Taftah, okay, which is the Hebrew year 4800, which corresponds to the English year 1040, rather. And what the Maharshal does, he introduces us to Rashi by saying that the year 1040 is not just any year on the calendar, but it marked the year of the death of the then leading scholar of the entire world of the entire world Jewish population, Rabbeinu Gershom. He died in the year 1040. And what the Maharshal does is connect the year of the death of the last great sage of the generation to the birth of the next great sage of the generation. The Rashi Nolad Oser Shana. Rashi was born in the same year. Again, we won't be able to, just a note about the calendar, we won't be able to know whether or not it was actually the year 1039 or 1040, because we don't know exactly when in the year Rashi was born. But statistically, it's more probable that it was 1040, but it could be 1039. Vayefi, Samech Hei Shanim, lived 65 years. V'niftar b'shnas dalet alafim v'taftaf Samech Hei, died in the English year 1105. So that is the birth and death of Rashi. I just want to say, by way of introduction, a number of biographical points. Now, who are Rashi's siblings? It's a trick question. Rashi was an only child. Actually, did not have any siblings, or at least any siblings that we know about. Rashi had how many sons? It's also a trick question. No sons, but he did have three daughters and three sons-in-law, who all went on in their own right to accomplish important things. And famously, Rashi's daughter Yocheved married a man named Meir. I'll keep that name in mind because that'll come up later on. And Meir and Yocheved had three children, each of whom became quite famous. Who were the three children? Also Rashi's grandchildren? Rashbam. What's the Rashbam's actual name? Shmuel, right? And Shmuel ben Meir. Whenever we have an acronym, it's Rashbam, Reishin Beis Mem. So it's Rabbi Shmuel ben Rabar Meir. Okay, that's Meir is the son of Rashi. So that's the Rashbam. That's one son. Rabbeinu Tam, who's actually the youngest of the three. Rabbeinu Tam, who went on to become the next great sage and the head of the Tosafist school. We may come back to him later on in the course of the semester. That's Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam's first name was Yaakov, right? So Rabbeinu Yaakov Tam. And the third son, who's probably the least well known of Rashi's grandsons, is a man by the name of, you know, Yitzchak. So Yitzchak is also one of the Tosafists, and he's referred to by the name Rivam. Rivam, right? Reish Yud Beis Mem. So three grandsons from Yocheved and Meir, and they go on to accomplish great things in their own life. I bring that up also to mention to you, there are a few pieces of, you can call them esoterica or trivia, but are actually fairly important to know in the study of Rashi. What's Rashi's name? Shlomo Yitzchak. So what does that mean? So Shlomo is his first name, and Yitzchak is his father. So if you're writing Hebrew acronyms, so you know the system how it works. So it's Reb something, then something. So what should Rashi really be called? Rashbi, right? It should be Reb Shimon ben, Reb Shlomo rather, ben Yitzchak. So how do you get the name Rashi? It should be Rashbi. Ever think about that? Any ideas? No, not a spelling error. Yitzchak, no, so we know why his name is, we know where the Yud comes from, but why did we drop the, why did we drop the base? It should be Rashbi. He should be the most famous commentator in Judaism. So, what's that? Rashbi would just mean Rav Shlomo ben Yitzchak. Like we say, Rashbam, or, you know, Ramban. It's always something ben, something. That's why there's always the bays in there, the bet sound. So why did we drop it? Isn't there another Rashbi? So, Naomi, you have it. Who is the other Rashbi? Rav Shimon bar Yochai, exactly. So, it was really just a historic, I don't want to call it an accident, it was quite intentional, but Rashi got the name Rashi so as to differentiate him from the other Rashbi, who was Rav, say it one more time? Rav Shimon bar Yochai. Okay, so if anybody stops you in the street and says, hey, I'll give you $10 million if you can tell me why Rashi's called Rashi and not Rashbi, now you know the answer. You could have called him Rashbi, that's really his name, or Shlomo ben Yitzchak. We dropped the bays in order to differentiate Rashi from Rav Shimon bar Yochai. Okay, now there's something interesting about Rashi, there are many interesting things about Rashi. When it comes to almost all of, let's say, Rashi's contemporaries or other Rishonim, Rishonim, we'll say, lived from the 11th century to the 15th century, the early, quote-unquote, commentators. So we typically know something about where they came from, in the sense that we know in what kind of school we can associate them. We can say that the Ramban was the teacher of the Rashba, and the Rashba was the teacher of the Ritzah, and there was a Mesorah, there was a tradition that linked us back to the Rebbeim, to the teachers, and to the mentors of a particular persona. So, who's Rashi's Rebbe? Who's Rashi's Rebbe? How come no one ever heard of Rashi's Rebbe? So, it's not entirely known, and there are hypotheses. And over the course of his commentaries in Shas and a little bit in Tanakh, Rashi does sometimes mention his Rebbeim. He does sometimes mention the people with whom he studied, and the people from whom he learned. The chief person who we assume, there's just a couple of handouts that you should grab on your way in, the chief person that we assume Rashi studied with is a man named Yaakov ben Yakar, who Rashi studied with in Worms. You can go back to the map and see where Worms is in relation to Tla. But that is the assumption, Rabbi Yaakov ben Yakar. But if you want my opinion, we know not that much about Rashi's Rebbeim and not that much about his teachers, because he's so willing to produce his own comments and his own commentaries and is much less reliant on his mentors and his teachers than many of his contemporaries. And that's why no one really could tell you on the street who is Rashi's Rebbe. It's really less important for us to know that. Which brings me to my joke for the evening. Who's the first person to learn Chumash with Rashi? It's Rashi's father. You get it? To learn Chumash with Rashi? Yes, that was my joke for the evening. My Rashi joke. But his father was one of his teachers. But we don't know that much about Rashi's teachers. Okay. Now let's talk for a moment about Rashi's biography. What did Rashi do professionally? How did he pay the rent? The doctor. The Rambam was a doctor. That we know. Rashi. I don't know if Rashi was a doctor.
He doctored the wine.
He doctored the wine. Okay, so we have one opinion for Ver Vintner. Any other thoughts?
Sold eggs.
Okay. Okay. Hey, I'll already come back to that. So, any other thoughts on what Rashi did? Definitely ran Yeshiva. Was definitely a teacher. So, jump for a second with me to the. I think it's the fourth page of your on the fourth page of your handout. I'm sorry I didn't put a title on top of this page. This is an article which was written by Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik in 1978. Now have a look with me. Again, I'm on page four of the handout. Have a look at the left-hand column of the page. Left-hand column of the page, just to get a sense of the context of what Rabbi Soloveitchik is talking about. Jewish communities were generally tiny, averaging from a handful to a score of families intended in the county of Champaign to make their own wine. As the crude state of barrel making made the aging of wine and its long-range storage impossible, wine was usually produced anew every fall. An entire year's consumption had to be provided for in the treading of September and early October, but since the holidays and Sukkot fell in these months, the time available for grape pressing was limited indeed. In contrast, the quantities of wine consumed in this age was, as we have already noted, enormous. It was taxing in the extreme to tread so large a quantity in so short a time with so little manpower. It's difficult to see how this was accomplished without the concerted effort of the entire community. Okay, now, have a look with me at footnote number 54. Okay. It is this, rather than any professional occupation as a vintner, that explains Rashi's off-sited remarks. Again, skipping the Hebrew, he says, the average Champagne household in the month of September very much resembled our own before Passover. The second passage usually cited in support of Rashi's supposed occupation, okay? Now again, as people mentioned, and the early biographers, including Sala Baron of Rashi, usually assumed that Rashi was indeed a vintner, and now Chaim Soloveitchik in 1978 is attempting to debunk that myth. The second passage usually cited in support of Rashi's supposed occupation refers most probably to Rabbi Isaac ben Judah. In the literature of his school, Rashi is never called Rabbeinu HaGadol, so he debunks another source, which we could have assumed indicated that Rashi was a vintner, but the former scholar is regularly referred to this way by the Masoretites in the Maaseh Gaon. Indeed, the presumption is against anyone being a wine grower in Tuah. Its chalky soil to this day is inhospitable to viticulture, and not surprisingly, as Elizabeth Chapin has found no references to vines in local documents. Contrast this with their frequent mention in the... anyone want to give me a... Barster. Okay, I'm going to butcher the French. Contrast this with their frequent mention in that region, a generation or so before Rashi, there seems to have been one solitary owner, or perhaps more accurately, only one major owner of vineyards among the Jews of Tuah. Undoubtedly, there were some local vines, probably for private use. Rashi's words almost imply as much. But that they should have regularly produced a surplus sufficient to afford a living is asking a great deal of them. Despite all this, Rashi may nevertheless have been a vintner, but by the same measure, he may well have been an egg salesman. Okay, so this is a little tongue-in-cheek on the part of Chaim Soloveitchik, but he's a scholar of the first order, and certainly, you know, once he sort of blows this myth out of the water, it leaves us uncertain as to what Rashi's given profession actually was. So I produced for you in the second handout a copy of a very easily accessible article written by a man named Meir Gruber, who's a professor in the Department of Biblical Archaeology and Ancient Near East Studies at Ben Gurion University. And we don't have to go through the entire thing right now, but if you'd like to have a look. He discusses some of the possibilities as to what may have been Rashi's occupation. But jump for a moment to the very bottom of page 2 of that handout. And it's a nice kind of summary of this issue. In the conventional presentation of the last line of page 2, in the conventional presentation of Rashi's biography, Rashi was assumed to have been a vintner by profession and the head of an academy of Jewish learning as an avocation. However, when Baron so described Rashi, the corpus of Rashi's response had not yet been published by Elfenbein. The facts, which can be culled from examination of the response, to hardly portray Rashi as an amateur rabbi slash scholar or his yeshiva as a hobby. In fact, the conventional presentation of Rashi's biography also fosters the widely accepted notion that religious instruction, the study of sacred texts, whether from historical or theological perspective, whether in the university, the yeshiva, the modern rabbinical seminary, the Jewish day school, or seminaries for teachers, or wherever, is or should be essentially a leisure activity. Careful reading of Rashi's response for what they tell us about daily life among Rashi and his disciples revealed that Rashi himself succeeded by his very professionalism in his very careful and by no means subtle design for making his yeshiva an intellectual and spiritual center for all of world Jewry, and indeed for all persons, both friendly and hostile, who wish to understand the Torah. In the opinion of this scholar, Rashi was a professional rabbi. He was a professional teacher. He was a Rosh Yeshiva. And in his opinion, there's no need to go looking for what may have been a side business or a means of making a living that could have occupied some of Rashi's time. Now that being said, as we'll discover, Rashi was something of a jack of all trades. He seems to have a working knowledge of animal husbandry and farming and viticulture, and it's clear that that Rashi was a student of many different types of scholarship. Whether or not he actually engaged in any of those areas professionally is something that is still a matter of some conjecture. Okay, any thoughts on Rashi's biography before we move forward? Yes, Matt.
As far as his profession, is it possible that he was so good at what he did that people just assumed he did it full time just because it was done so well that he could have done it a lot less?
It could be. He may have worked 1 month a year and made a living doing, you know, who knows? I think that is an open question. Okay.
He wasn't a businessman.
It didn't seem like he was a businessman, but there are Yeah, it's actually a good segue. So thank you for that question, Elsa, and I'll answer the question in the next moment. What did Rashi produce? He wrote a commentary on Talmud, almost the entire thing, not everything, but almost about 30 tractates, almost the entire Talmud, the Torah, Tanakh, almost the entire Tanakh. We'll have to come back to this conversation a little later. There are some commentaries which appear with the heading of Rashi in your standard Tanakh, which are actually not written by Rashi, but probably, or more likely, by some of his students, including the commentary on Dibur HaYamim and probably Iyov, maybe segments of another couple commentaries. But for all intents and purposes, not to take anything away from what Rashi produced, an entire commentary on the Talmud, an entire commentary on Tanakh. In addition to that, he also wrote responsa, Shilos and Tshuva. He was a rabbi in the community. He received letters, people asking him halachic questions, and he would decide those halachic matters. And those decisions are documented in over 300 responsa, which have been collected and documented. And in addition to that, and this is something we'll return to, Rashi also ran yeshiva. And the notion that it was a guy sitting in a dark room with a candle writing a commentary is a notion that we shouldn't have. Rashi's productions, Rashi's commentaries, are oftentimes a collaborative effort in the sense that Rashi was the teacher, he had students, and very often in the Beis Medrash, in the dialogue, in the conversation that would arise, commentaries would emerge and Rashi and his students would record them. So very often a comment that we'll see is actually a kind of combination between something Rashi said, maybe something his student said at the time, maybe something his student added later on. So there is sometimes some ambiguity to the originality of the text, or really more precisely the origin of the text. And I want to come back to that in just a moment. Okay. Now, just a couple of other notes before we get to the main section of tonight's introduction. Just one footnote, really, and then we'll move forward. What is Rashi's script? If you have a look at the very back page of the source sheet, I've produced for you the alphabet. Just very simply, the Hebrew alphabet in what we call block letters and what we call Rashi script. So, what is Rashi's script? What is Rashi's script?
It's part Aramaic.
Part Aramaic. Well, it's interesting. Meaning, in Rashi's commentary in the Talmud, he does write sometimes in using the Aramaic language because that's the language primarily of the Talmud. But again, Rashi lives in the 11th century. Okay. Rashi lives in the 11th century. The printing press is invented in the 15th century. The first printed text of Rashi appears very early on. The first printed text of Rashi appears actually independent from the Chumash. We usually assume it's Chumash with Rashi. The first printed book of Rashi's commentary on the Bible appeared as an independent book. It was just Rashi's glosses, and I guess if you wanted to understand them, either had to have intimate familiarity with the text itself, or use the two texts side by side. The truth of the matter is, what we call Rashi's script is not the script in which Rashi wrote at all. It happened to be the preferred script of one of the publishers, and on all likelihood one of the non-Jewish publishers, who published Rashi in conjunction with the text of the Chumash and other commentaries in a format that would later become called the Mikraot Gedolot, the Mikraos Gedolot, to differentiate Rashi from the text of the Torah and the other texts of the other commentators. The publisher, or the editor at the time, used a script which we colloquially call Rashi script, and placed Rashi in that kind of cursive script. It would be the equivalent of of someone setting the typeface in 2007 using Times New Roman in one column and wanting to differentiate some other part of the text and using Arial or a different font to set them apart, not because they're fundamentally different, not because they come from different eras, but really just as a matter of let's say textual or graphic design. This was the text, or this was the typeface that was used by that publisher in one of the first texts of the Mikraos Gedolot in the early part of the 16th century. Forevermore, it's been called Rashi script, but it's really a misnomer. Rashi wrote in whatever level of evolution the script happened to be in. Refer you to a very good article on the Hebrew language in the Encyclopedia Judaica. You can sort of see the evolution of the Hebrew language. Whatever happened to be the prevailing script in the 11th century is the script Rashi used, and didn't look anything like the script that we actually call Rashi script. Yes, Steve?
We have copies of his original writings.
Okay, so you guys are great. That is the perfect segue into the very next thing that I wanted to discuss. One of the biggest obstacles, if not the biggest challenge, in understanding Rashi's commentary on both the Torah and the Talmud, is the fact that we have no original manuscripts. We have zero original manuscripts. What makes it even worse, we don't have anything close to an original manuscript. Now, Rashi, again, 1040 to 1105. You know what the earliest manuscript of Rashi we have is? It's from the year 1233. That's 128 years after Rashi is dead. Okay? So that's a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy. That could be a 20th generation text. Now, not the historian of printing and manuscripts, but typically, if you have an unpopular text, you have an esoteric text that's not in wide circulation, so the manuscripts are going to either be preserved or not. But if they're preserved, so you'll have a manuscript and maybe a couple times in the course of a century it'll be copied or reproduced, whatever, and you'll have a second manuscript. Rashi, already in his lifetime, was wildly popular because he was so revolutionary, and we'll talk about why. Because he was so revolutionary, because he was so popular, everyone wanted to know about Rashi's commentary. There's no printing press in the 11th century, so how do you produce the text of Rashi? So you get a copy of a copy of a copy, whatever the local scribe happens to get his hands on. So if you were living in the 11th century, if you were living concurrently with Rashi, the chances of your having a good original source were between slim and none. And that was in the 11th century, because Rashi's commentaries were already in such wide circulation. They were being copied and copied and copied. We're talking about a text, the earliest and best text we have is from the year 1233. I mean, you're going to have literally hundreds and hundreds of errors of emendations, and as we'll talk about more, Rashi wasn't a one-hit wonder. Rashi created an entire pshat school. Rashi basically gave birth to a new generation of biblical commentary and biblical interpretation, which was really pioneered and let's say refined, for lack of a better word, by his grandchildren and the later French Tosafists. So what you had was Rashi's students taking originals or copies, taking those texts and amending them, adding their own notes. So what you're looking at is not even a, when say you're a scribe and you're trying to copy a good manuscript of Rashi's text, the best manuscript of Rashi's text is going to be littered with glosses and additions and notes and scratches in the margins. So the chance of getting your hands on a good edition of a Rashi manuscript are slim and none to begin with. And then by the time you get to the manuscripts that we have, which again are only from 130 years after Rashi's death, your chance of getting a good original text are zero. There's absolutely no chance. In the 900 years since Rashi's death, no one has ever produced a critical edition of Rashi. And again, not being a scholar of printing and manuscripts, how do you get a good text? What do you do to get, say you're a scholar of the commentary of the Chassam Sofer, and lived in the 19th century, you want to republish it. So how do you get a good text? You don't have the original, you have some copies. So you take the text that you do have, and you line them up, and you compare them. And you see, okay, well, 9 out of 10 have this version. The chances are that's the right one, and the 10th one is an error. So we can piece together the 9 out of 10, we'll get a pretty good sense, or at least statistically improve our chances of coming up with a good text. Now, in the 1860s, for the first time in the history of Rashi, in the history of the world, Abraham Berliner produced the first attempt at a critical edition of Rashi. It was published in 1866. He got his hands on 10 manuscripts. Earliest one being from the 13th century. Most of them were from the 14th and 15th century. But at least he had 10 manuscripts. And he could attempt to piece together from those 10 manuscripts a critical edition of Rashi. He republished 40 years later in 1905 a new critical edition of Rashi, which was based on 100 manuscripts. Now you're already talking about something significant. You have 100 manuscripts. You can start to piece together what might be the best possible edition of Rashi. With that said, there are still hundreds and hundreds of areas of ambiguity, if not outright error, which leads to the problem of knowing what is it Rashi even said before we can begin to interpret or analyze any of Rashi's content. So that, Steve, is the answer to your short question. Which is that we have a real uphill battle in this course at any time we look at a text of Rashi. Yeah?
Since they were copied over so many times, is there any proof that they were copied exactly from the first or add things on their own?
There's typically no way to know. Meaning, if I could be a scribe and I could think that I know better than the previous scribe, I'll say, oh, that must not be a lamed, that must be a nun.
No,
and it didn't say the word lo, it said the word na.
Well,
so I change it.
One thing is some things say they didn't like certain comments that Rashi made and say, well, I know better than him, and just changed it.
That's absolutely true. We'll come back to comments where other commentaries say explicitly that. They'll say, I made this change, I made this emendation. What's more problematic is when they don't tell us, right? And there's just it's just a new edition which didn't exactly preserve the oldest edition. Clarissa?
What was there about Rashi's commentaries that made them head and shoulders above all the many others?
So that is the $64,000 question, which I want to begin to answer tonight, but really will be the project of the next 6 or 7 classes over the course of this semester. Mr. Kaplan? That is a great question. Mr. Kaplan asked, before Rashi, were there other commentaries? The short answer is, Not in the classic sense. What we'll talk more about is the role of Midrash as a commentary or as an aid to understanding the Torah. the entire body of the Midrash really even continued after Rashi's time. But let's say the main scope of this, and we'll talk more about it, I don't mean to give short shrift to this question, the main scope of Midrashic literature was composed really, let's say, between the year 0 and the year 1000. Right? And that was the closest thing that really existed to a commentary on the Torah. If you wanted to pick up a Chumash and understand what a particular pasuk meant, the only place really to look was the corpus of Midrashim that that existed as an interpretive means of better understanding the text. But there was no one who was telling you, you know, the meaning of that particular word is this, or let me explain to you what this is all about. Really, all you had was the Midrashic literature. Elsa.
From this map, it looks like he traveled.
Yeah.
Quite a bit.
Yeah.
So where does the language
come? The language of
writing or whatever.
Yeah. So that's a great question. And again, we'll talk a little more about it. Basically, the lingua franca of Rashi's region is French, or what we know today as scholars call Old French. And one of Rashi's exegetical techniques is to use Old French as a means by which to explain a particular problem in the text or a particular concept. So sometimes he'll say, you know, this obscure word means a woven basket, which is known in French as a, you know, and he'll give you the word because he's writing for his contemporary audience. So it would be the same as Yeah, so it's present-day German. Basically, in Rashi's, everyone's talking French. Everyone's talking French. The basic assumption is that Rashi obviously knew Aramaic and Hebrew, and as we'll talk more about, when we talk about the relationship he had with his Christian contemporaries, there's a good chance that he had a working knowledge of Latin. And was able to understand the Latin texts that were circulating around that time. Okay. Yes?
Isn't it true that on his commentary on the Chumash, he didn't add anything? All he did was choose from the Russian that existed beforehand?
So it's like five for five. So that is the perfect segue to the very next thing I wanted to talk about. Just as a footnote to the last... area that we just discussed, just to give you a sense, just to sort of whet your appetite, a commentary, of course, is a work that's written to explain a primary text. So Rashi, the Ramban, the Rashban, those are all commentaries on the Torah. A super commentary is a commentary on a commentary. Right? So if somebody writes a commentary on Rashi, That's a super commentary. Anyone know how many super commentaries have been written on Rashi? The last count, over 250 super commentaries have been written on Rashi. Okay, so forget the Torah. They're not even working with it. They're just trying to understand Rashi, right? So, and again, part of the struggle is this real historical problem that we don't have great texts. And we don't have great manuscripts to really know what it is that Rashi said, so that produces a whole slew of ambiguity. But even when we do know what he says, you have over 250 super commentaries trying to explain where Rashi is coming from and what it is that he is saying. So that's a good question. There was basically an operative convention. That probably began, say, post-Talmud, probably in the Gaonic period, in the 9th, 10th, 11th century, that any, let's say, any commentaries or any documents or any writings that pertain to Torah, you know, even correspondence. If you're the big rabbi and I'm writing, ask you a question, I'm going to write it in maybe the language I know best, but you're going to answer in Hebrew, and that's going to be for a couple of reasons. One is, it's amazing, Old French. If Rashi had written his commentary in Old French, you know, we'd be dead in the water. We'd be dealing with a translation of his commentary. We'd never be able to access the the original. You know, he wrote it in Hebrew, which preserved the commentary really way beyond his lifetime. So, you know, it's an interesting question. There are commentaries written by big rabbis. You know, Chancellor Raphael Hirsch in the 19th century wrote a famous commentary. He wrote it in German because he wanted people in his generation to understand it. So it was a give and take. You know, now if you want to see Samson Raphael Hirsch's commentary on the Torah, you got to read it in translation unless you know 19th century German. So if you want to be able to preserve something in its original, you write it in Hebrew, and that's why 99% of commentaries on the Torah are written in Hebrew. That is a great question. Rashi went off to yeshiva in Worms at around age 17, and stayed there for about 8 years. And chances are he began to write around that time, sometime between age 17 and 25. But I don't know if we have any way of knowing. Certainly not known to me. If we have any way of pinpointing even more accurately at what time he began to write his commentary. Incidentally, it's mind-boggling to think how much Rashi covered. I mean, there are people today, if they produce in their lifetime a commentary on one book of Tanakh, that's like, wow, that's unbelievable, right? Or one tractate of Quran. He covered everything. I mean, all that was out there, he covered Shas, almost the entire Talmud, and he covered the entire Tanakh. So it's really it's beyond mind blowing.
That's why I asked my question. I mean, what was his day like? I mean,
just supports right. Yeah, but that really just supports that the notion we brought up from this fellow Gruber. It's like he was, you know, tilling the field from 9 to 5. You know, how did he produce all this? This work in his spare time? You know, so you really have to believe that, you know, he's working on this day and night. And he did it without Rashi. Yeah, exactly.
Why is the presumption that he would not be paid for working as a Rosh Hashiva? Is that sort of a presumption while they're looking for some other profession for him?
Well, there's a standing presumption that anyone involved in Jewish communal service isn't going to be able to make enough money to pay the rent. Which we're doing a little better with nowadays, but in the 11th century, that was, you know, there wasn't necessarily the infrastructure. Again, a lot of it had to do with the fact that the community is so small. You may have 100 Jews, and that's a Mecca. So, you know, 100, how are they able to pay or support, you know, an entire family or a number of families, you know, who are learning or teaching, who are, you know, so that's why there's this kind of struggle to understand, well, how did actually, and maybe he inherited a portion from his, you know, who knows? And maybe he didn't have to, maybe he didn't have to work. Yes. So that's a great question. That is a great question. We have a little better manuscripts from, let's say, Rashbam, you know, his grandson. But even those, we don't have a ton of. Part of it had to do with anti-Semitism, in the sense that, you know, every 2 seconds, and I'm exaggerating a little, but already in 1096, in Rashi's lifetime, is the first crusade. You know, so they just burned down your house and you're running to the next neighborhood to try and, Rashi's own, you know, nieces and nephews were killed in crusades. So that's part of it, is sometimes the manuscripts just don't survive, you know, in Rashi's own lifetime. And that's true both for Rashi and for his contemporaries. You know, you had the massive book burnings in the 13th century in Paris. So even if you had good manuscripts that survived 200 years, you know, it's anti-Semitism in the 13th century wiped those out. You know, they burned thousands and thousands of manuscripts. And, you know, it just exacerbated the problem that Rashi was so popular. You know, he was a victim of his own success in the sense that, you know, so many manuscripts got out, even in his lifetime, that anything that survived is going to be a copy of a copy. And
when Rashi did his commentary on the Talmud,
yeah,
he didn't have Rashi? Everyone who came after said, without Rashi, we couldn't handle it.
Yeah.
Even the great Gadol.
Yeah.
So the job must have been enormously multiplied.
I
starting from scratch.
It's unfathomable. Truly starting from scratch. Okay. Now, I don't want to leave tonight without doing some text study, without actually learning some Rashi. We've talked a lot about Rashi, and we could talk for a lot more time about Rashi, and we will. But I don't want that to come at the expense of the learning that I'd like to do together. Okay. Incidentally, as a segue to the learning that we'll do in the next few minutes that we have left, I just want to point out a text which sort of concludes the last couple of conversations that we have. This is a text that came out just a few years ago called the Ariel Chumash. Right now, it's available for... There's only two volumes, I think. This is Bereishis to Chayasar, and the next one is maybe the next three or four Parshios. In existence right now, to my knowledge, this is the best text of Rashi. It's what you have on page 5 and following is is copied from this text. So you have the text of the Chumash, you have Rashi, you have a translation of Rashi, and you have very good annotations. What they've done is they've basically culled from those 250 super commentaries, or from the top 25 of those super commentaries, they've taken the best explanations to help elucidate what it is that's on Rashi's mind, and helps us get a sense of what it is the Rashi's doing. So I don't make a commission on this by recommending it to you, but if you're interested in finding the best text of Rashi, and again, it's because they've used so many manuscripts to try and come up with the most accurate text, this is really it. Okay, so let's begin by learning a Rashi together, and I figured we could begin with our parsha. Okay, so let's learn the Rashi on Pasuk Vav. Okay, this is the beginning of Parshas Lech Lecha. Just to place you, let's begin on page. Let's begin on page 5. Okay? Page 5, the third line in the Chumash. So Hashem has given Abraham literally his marching orders. And the Torah says, Vayikach Abraham es Sarah ishto, ves Lot ben Achiv, ves kol rechusham asher rechashu, ves hanefesh asher asu, becharan, vayitzu lechus arz ha-Kanan, vayavo arz ha-Kanan. Okay? So the Torah says, Abraham took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his nephew, and all of the wealth that they had accrued, and all of the nefesh, asher asu b'charan. We'll come back to that perhaps a different time. Either the converts that they had taken in, or their household servants. They started to head toward Canaan, right from Haran. They started to head toward Canaan, and they arrived in the land of Canaan. Okay. Now I want to ask you a question. Follow with me. I'm on page 6. The top line. Okay. So in verse number 5, the Torah just said, as we just read, they left the place called Haran and they came to the land of Canaan. Vayavur Avram ba'aretz ad mekom Shechem ad Elon Moreh, and they crossed the border. They got to Shechem and Elon Moreh. V'haknani az ba'aretz. Someone just translate those three words. Vakneni as ba'aretz, nothing fancy. What does it mean? The Canaanites were then in the land. Yeah, as ba'aretz, were then in the land. Anyone find that a little strange? What land are we talking about? So who do you expect to live in Canaan, if not the Canaanites? Oh, we arrived in America, and guess what we found? Americans. No kidding. Of course they're. Of course the Canaanites are in the land. What else would be happening in the land? Now look at Rashi. Rashi says the most amazing things. And the reason I'm excited about this class is because I get to share them with you. It blows your mind. These Rashis that maybe we learned in second grade, if we remember them, they're unbelievable. V'aknani az ba'aretz. Do you see where it is? It's the fifth line of Rashi on the right-hand column, and you have both the Hebrew and the English. You can follow along in Ida. So how can any Asbaras? Look at Rashi's commentary. Again, what I want to do is tease out some of the themes that we'll see over and over recurring in Rashi's commentary to help answer Clarissa's question with which we started. What makes Rashi so head and shoulders above any other commentary? Hakneni Asbaras. So, what is that? So Rashi says, first of all, Hayah Olech the Kodesh as Eretz Yisrael, Mizaro Shel Shem. So Rashi gives us a history lesson. Okay? Look at the English translation. The Canaanite nation was gradually conquering the land of Israel, the land of Canaan, from the descendants of Shem. Okay? Who's Canaan and who's Shem? Back up with me a couple generations. Noah had three sons. Shem, Ham, and Yaphet. Okay? So Canaan is from Ham. Okay? So Canaan means the descendants of Ham were in the land of, okay, in this land that we're calling Canaan. Okay? So what were they doing there? So Rashi says it's totally revolutionary. The Canaanite nation was gradually conquering the land of Israel from the descendants of Shem. That's unbelievable. From Shem? Well, who's Shem? Shem is Noah's son, and where do we come from? Shem. Abraham is a direct descendant of Shem. So Rashi says, you know who really should have been in the land? Shem. He says, I'll tell you how I know it. Shebechelko shel Shem nafla, kishechalak Noach es ha'aretz l'bna. He says, when Noach divided up the land to give to his children, where did the land of Israel end up? In whose portion? In the portion of Shem. He says, and I'll prove it to you. Shenemar, because the Pasuk says, Umalki Tzedek Melech Shalem. What's the proof of Malki Tzedek Melech Shalem? So first he makes an equation. He says he has a Masorah that Malki Tzedek, this guy named Malki Tzedek, was actually Shem. Malki Tzedek Melech Shalem. And what's Shalem? Yerushalayim. Why is Yerushalayim called Yerushalayim? It's a combination of the words Yerushalayim. Right? So Shalem is Yerushalayim, which is obviously in the center of the land of Israel. The land, if Shalem is in the portion of the land that belongs to Shem, obviously Israel is in the land, in the portion of the land that belongs to Shem. Lefikach, that's why in the next pasuk Rashi, she says, Vayomer Abraham, that's why God tells Abraham, you know, this promise of the land that we think is such a out of the nowhere, Abraham was just this guy who, he struck gold. One day God appeared to him and says, are you going to be a great nation? You're going to inherit this land. Rashi says, it's not a surprise to Abraham because this land really belonged to his great-grandfather. The fact that someone is occupying it now, that's what's the anomaly. The anomaly is not for Abraham to inherit this land. The anomaly is for anyone else to be in this land. That's why when Hashem says, "Lezarecha etenes haaretz hazos," asid ani lahazira lebanecha shehem nizara shel shem. When Abraham is promised that his children are going to inherit the land, it's not news. Rashi is rewriting the whole script. He's saying that Hashem is promising not to give the land to Abraham, but to lahazira, to return the land to Abraham. In one fell swoop, right? It's amazing, in these four lines, Rashi rewrites the whole narrative. The whole narrative, the whole conversation between Hashem and Abraham, it's totally different. It's not a new gift that Hashem is giving to Abraham, to the future generations of the Jewish people. He's just returning what was rightfully in the hands of someone else. Hakanini Asbaretz. Rashi says, that's the violation. Why else would the Torah go out of its way to say Hakanini Asbaretz? Who else would you expect to find in the land of Canaan? Rashi says, of course, no. It's a chiddush, it's a newsflash. The Torah is revealing something that's surprising to us. Canaan was given by Noach to Shem. We shouldn't find Canaan, we shouldn't find the Canaanites in the land at all. That they're there is the violation. Hashem's promise is only to restore the land to its proper owner, to the descendants of Shem, to Abraham and his children. Seal?
Yeah. I'm just questioning why it says Avraham. It's not Avraham.
Yeah, so that's a great point. He's about to become, if I say Avraham, it's only because our convention is to call him Avraham, but it's true, you're right to correct and say, at this point, he's still Avraham. Totally correct. Yes? Tell me your name one more time.
Abby.
Abby, sorry.
So, I guess my question, because
I
always said about Rashi, like, he comes up with these things, but how do we know it's what we're talking about?
That is a great question. If everyone has two more minutes, I want to look at one last source. The question was, essentially, Abby, do you want to repeat the question?
If Rashi always came up with these new ideas, why do we call him the first person to see it? How do we know that it's
okay.
At least in this example, it just seems so right.
Exactly. Right. So what I was saying is that, and maybe we'll close with this without looking at the last source. We'll pick up with this next time. In the interest of time. What I was saying is sometimes, and we'll see. There are many answers to your question. Sometimes the answer is Rashi just makes such a compelling argument that when you hear it, it just makes so much sense that yeah, that's great. That's a great explanation. It's not necessarily the only explanation, and we'll talk about one of the revolutions of Rashi in his acceptance of a kind of plurality or a kind of exegetical pluralism in the sense that he doesn't always believe the explanation that he recommends is the only or right explanation, and he's willing to accept multiple interpretations, and sometimes he even suggests a priori multiple interpretations. But sometimes, and we'll see, the basis for the argument is just so compelling that you see on its own merits, it becomes almost just accepted because it just sounds so right, as Ira correctly points out. So next,
Manny, go ahead. Can we look to Talmudic Medrash?
Yes.
As its source? Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the main interest. If you're interested, the back page on source number 4 on page 10. You can see where it's all coming from. It's an earlier medrash, and we'll talk about next time one of the contributions of Rashi, that he didn't just quote the medrash, but he reworked it. He reframed it for various reasons, which we will, which we hopefully will talk about next time. I'll just ask, if you didn't have a chance to sign in, there is a sign-in sheet, so please do so. And I look forward to seeing you all next week at the same time, 7 p.m. on Tuesday. Thank you all. Not exactly, but there is a sense that.
You know what I mean?